Friends, to the Weekend Interview Show for April 30th, 2005. I'm Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives there in MP3 format for you. And I want to begin today with a quote from Garrett Garrett from The Rise of Empire, 1952. We have crossed the boundary that lies between republic and empire. If you ask when, the answer is that you cannot make a single stroke between day and night. The precise moment does not matter. There was no painted sign to say, you are now entering Imperium. Yet it was a very old road, and the voice of history was saying, whether you know it or not, the act of crossing may be irreversible. And now, not far ahead, is a sign that reads, no U-turns. And to discuss America's descent into empire, or rise of it, as you like to look at it, today is Justin Raimondo. He's the author of Reclaiming the American Right, The Lost Legacy of the Conservative Movement, Into the Bosnian Quagmire, The Case Against American Intervention in the Balkans, An Enemy of the State, The Life of Murray N. Rothbard, and The Terror Enigma, 9/11 and the Israeli Connection. He's a contributing editor for the American Conservative Magazine, is an adjunct scholar with the Ludwig von Mises Institute, writes for Chronicles Magazine, and is the editorial director of and writes behind the headlines for antiwar.com. Welcome to the show, Justin Raimondo.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you on. And I know you're working on a new book called The Neocons. So let's start there with the word neoconservative. Many people use it to mean basically conservatives nowadays, which would include the average Republican Party member, I guess. But you use the word neoconservative in your writings much more specifically.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, it's really hard to define what a neoconservative is because since the whole goal of neoconservatism is the acquisition of power, the actual ideology changes, to be whatever is convenient at that moment. But, I mean, basically, there's one strand that sort of defines their thought from A to Z, which is an interventionist foreign policy. I mean, they've always stood for that. From the Cold War to today, they've always said, let's go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. So
this is not so much really an ideological definition as it is a biographical designation in your eyes.
Yes, roughly.
So who exactly are the neoconservatives then? In Reclaiming the Right, you make the case that there was an old right that somehow got conservatism stolen away from them. Who were they and who took it?
Well, I mean, that's a long, long sort of conversation. I would suggest people get my book, Reclaiming the American Right, The Lost Legacy of the Conservative Movement. Unfortunately, it's out of print, but you could have it in your library. But briefly, there was an old right, and it used to stand for limited government, a non-interventionist foreign policy of peace through strength, and, small government, the old America. Now, the conservative movement stands for what? Well, it stands for bigger government spending, it stands for the Patriot Act, and, of course, it stands for empire abroad. According to the Bush Doctrine now, we have the right to preemptively attack anyone. And, of course, our goal has to be not, like the defense of America and our interests, but, spreading democracy. So.
All right. It's Justin Raimondo. He's the head writer from antiwar.com. We'll be right back after this break on the Weekend Interview Show. Brad, my friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Justin Raimondo from antiwar.com. And we're talking about how conservatism changed from being a philosophy of limited government and laissez-faire to being the imperial warfare, welfare state supporting philosophy that it is today. And in your book, Reclaiming the Right, Justin, you talk about this movement that grew up in opposition to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and to World War II.
Right.
And how basically after the end of World War II and the onset of the Cold War, they were sort of marginalized by official conservatism.
Right. You see, you know, you have to understand that the old right, you know, the old conservatives saw war as a major problem. You know, I mean, war really, you know, like empowered the state. And, of course, in wartime, everything is centralized. Everything is militarized, including the economy and people's personal lives. So that's why they opposed us going into World War II. All conservatives did, pretty much. And there was a massive peace movement called the America First Committee, which was run and started and financed by conservatives. In fact, Henry Regnery was one of the main funders of it. Regnery of the Regnery Publishing Company of today, which now publishes warmongering books like Ann Coulter's stuff, which is an irony. But, I mean, it just goes to show you how this movement was transformed into its exact opposite today.
Now, see, people my age, I'm 28, and I think people in my generation, we've always known conservatism to mean, you know, Ronald Reagan invading little islands at the drop of a hat.
It's, right.
The right wing, people identify conservatism means support for empire at all costs. So
yeah,
it's interesting when you talk about during World War II, it was the liberals who wanted to go and save Russia and save Great Britain, and it was the conservatives who wanted nothing to do with it.
Well, you know, the key phrase there is save Russia.
Ah.
You see, because they wanted to save the Soviet Union. Now, of course, when Hitler was allied with Stalin, they were anti-war. But they weren't really anti-war. They were just pro-Stalin. So, you know, as soon as the Hitler-Stalin pact was over and Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, what happened is that, you know, it was a famous story that there was a communist speaker speaking in Union Square, which was, you know, like sort of a center of commie activity in the 1930s in, you know, like New York City. And he was speaking saying, yes, this is an imperialist war and blah, blah, blah. And then somebody handed him a note saying, you know, that Stalin had just been invaded by Hitler. And in mid-speech, the guy turned on a dime, and all of a sudden he started denouncing the, you know, like the imperialists, you know, Nazis and this and that and the other thing, and yes, we have to smash them. And suddenly, you know, people were hearing the new line of, oh, yes, it's, you know,
well, there's,
you know,
a split.
It's time to enter the war.
There's, there's a split here among communists that begins to explain what's happened to conservatism, right, between the Stalinists and the Trotskyites. What were they fighting about?
Well, okay, you know, the followers of Leon Trotsky asserted that Stalin had, you know, like betrayed the communist revolution, that, you know, since Stalin was dedicated to, I mean, you know, like basically, it was a power struggle. Trotsky lost out, got kicked out of the country, and started his own dissident communist movement. And then he made up all kinds of objections to Stalinism that he had never expressed, really, inside the Soviet Union. And one of them was that Stalin had insisted on building socialism in Russia first, and then maybe spreading it, you know, like throughout the world. Trotsky said, well, you can't have socialism in one country. You have to have, you know, like what's called a permanent revolution. You have to spread communism all over the world. And Stalin, he said, had, you know, betrayed this principle of internationalism. So that was the fight between them. But it's interesting how the Trotskyites, eventually, lots of them found their way into the conservative movement.
In your book, you talk about a guy named Max Schachtman, who was a member of Trotsky's Fourth International. Is that right?
Right. Schachtman started out in the Communist Party in like the 1920s, and he joined when he was a teenager. And then eventually he was kicked out along with two other guys, and they together founded a Trotskyist party in the U.S., the Socialist Workers' Party, or what came to be known as the Socialist Workers' Party. But Schachtman was faced with a crisis, World War II. Okay, so the official Trotskyite line was that World War II was an imperialist war and that they couldn't support anybody. They were against it. But Schachtman was for it. See, war always poses the question point blank, which side are you on? So people are forced to take a position. And this moved Schachtman along on what became a 40-year journey to the right. So he split from Trotsky. And at that time, there was another person who was very prominent in the Socialist Workers' Party, and that was James Burnham. He would later become a founding editor of National Review. He was a professor at NYU. He was a noted philosopher and author and editor. And he was also a champion of Trotskyism. But these guys were moved to break with Trotsky over the question of the Second World War. And so
they were still communists. They just weren't exactly Trotskyites anymore, but they weren't quote-unquote conservatives yet.
Right. I mean, Schachtman evolved this whole theory that the Soviet Union had become what he called bureaucratic collectivist. And that meant that a new ruling class had established itself based on collectivized property forms in the USSR, and that they had betrayed true socialism. So that they were more fascist than anything.
Well, which is what every communist says when anyone ever points to an example of what a failure communism is, that, well, that's not the actual communism. The actual communism would work great.
Right.
And the fact that this didn't is the proof that it's not really communism.
Right, exactly.
No.
You know, sort of a circular argument there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, I mean, over this long period of time, I mean, Schachtman had a tremendous influence on the American left. Because here was a position that, you know, you could take and not be contaminated by the actual crimes of Stalin. You know, yes, I'm a socialist, but, you know, I'm against all, you know, all this bad stuff that's going on. And no, I'm not a Trotskyist, really, because I'm for the war. And so Schachtman eventually became a very moderate kind of socialist. And he embedded himself and his group, which went through several name changes and several transformations, but eventually became known as a group, which still exists today, which is called Social Democrats USA. And they embedded themselves in the AFL-CIO. And, I mean, Schachtman became obsessed with communism. He became a fervent anti-communist. But he was not, but he was a communist. That's the irony of it. He was a communist, but he hated Stalinism. So he wanted to destroy his old enemies. And, of course, you know, this is a syndrome that we see a lot of these days and have seen a lot of for, a long time, ex-communists becoming obsessed with their old comrades. And, you know, and they're just into, let's destroy, you know, Stalinism. And so he actually endorsed LBJ and the Vietnam War. He was for the Vietnam War. And he was instrumental in getting the AFL-CIO to go into Vietnam and set up these so-called free trade unions. And this was the genesis of the government agency that's called today the National Endowment for Democracy.
Oh.
And in fact, the longtime national director of Social Democrats USA was the first national director of the National Endowment for Democracy, who was brought in during the Reagan administration. And by this time, of course, you know, the Shachmanites had infiltrated the conservative movement, basically.
So I guess when in the 1970s, when these guys were supporting the Vietnam War, and yet the typical American left-winger were turning into hippies and into the anti-war movement, is that how these guys started moving to the more into the Republican Party then?
They didn't break with the Republican.
I'm sorry, Justin. I just asked you a question right up against the break. I apologize about
that. All right. Well, I'll think about the answer.
Okay, you do that, and we'll be right back. We're talking with Justin Raimondo. He's the author of Reclaiming the American Right, The Lost Legacy of the Conservative Movement, and he's the head writer for antiwar.com. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with my boss at antiwar.com, Justin Raimondo. And the question is, Justin, about how these Trotskyites surrounding this guy, Max Shachman, how they became conservatives in the period between, like, say, the Vietnam War and through the 1970s.
Okay, so, you know, the Shachmanites opposed the New Left, and they opposed the liberal opposition to the Vietnam War. And they basically teamed up with Senator Henry M. Jackson, known as Scoop Jackson. And Scoop was a classical New Deal liberal. He was firmly pro-labor, and he was hardline or hawkish on confronting communism in the international realm. And so he ran for president in 1972. And his campaign was a massive failure. George McGovern was supported by the New Left, and of course, you know, they won out. So that is basically when the split came. You know, the Shachmanites kind of dropped out of, you know, like Democratic Party politics, but they didn't have anywhere else to go until the election of Ronald Reagan. You know, because the Shachmanites and the neocons, now the neocons were kind of gathered around Norman Podhoretz, Midge Decker, and Commentary Magazine. So they were moving also toward the right. And then these two groups met up and basically merged, you know, for all intents and purposes. And then, of course, Podhoretz supported Reagan. And when Reagan was elected, you know, a number of neocons and their Shachmanite friends were actually appointed to jobs in the Reagan administration. Carl Gershman, Gene Kirkpatrick, who was an old member of Social Democrats USA, incredibly enough, and a whole bunch of other people who were not as famous, came into the Reagan administration. And they started moving rightward. But it's interesting that, you know, Social Democrats USA to this day insists that they are socialists. So they would argue about what that term means.
Well, let's see if I can throw a little more confusion into the mix here with Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago.
Yes.
And his affiliation with this guy, Albert Wolfstetter, who is some sort of Dr. Strangelove nuclear warfare strategist type. Who are these people, and what tie do they have to neoconservatism?
Well, I mean, that is a much more abstruse conversation. Leo Strauss was a refugee from Hitler's Germany. He was a scholar. He was a Hegelian. Well, it's hard to explain Strauss, but, I mean, basically what Strauss believed is that in history, certain philosophers have not said what they really mean, that they say one thing, but that you have to read people like Plato and Aristotle and all these ancient philosophers with the knowledge that they had to be careful what they said, because there are all these illusions that have to be promoted to keep society together, basically. Like belief in God, like belief in morality.
Pledging allegiance to the flag.
Right, yeah. You know, God, state, and nation. And, but that these are really myths that have no real validity. But they have to be preserved anyway to keep us from chaos. But true intellectuals know that it's all false.
That's interesting, though, because it sounds like, I mean, Strauss is always painted as such a revolutionary, but it sounds like what you're talking about is ends justify the means conservatism. He's trying to preserve America and the flag and God and all that great old stuff.
Well, right, but, I mean, it's not what he said, it's his method that's important. Because what he's saying is that there's truth, but only an elite few can truly understand and appreciate what it means. And furthermore, truth is not to be known by the masses. The masses have to be protected from the truth. So one of the functions of being an intellectual is to create these myths, i.e. lies. And they must actually defend these lies. So that lying is actually an act of virtue, which, you know, the architects of our policy in Iraq would probably tend to agree with, since so many of them were students of Strauss.
Right. See, now that's the question. The idea definitely rings true, but who among the people in the Bush administration were followers of Strauss? What is the connection between Strauss then and this government now?
Well, you know, I actually do not have a list, but it is quite long. Wolfowitz, it's one of them.
Pearl, too, right?
Mr. Chalabi. Ahmed Chalabi.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, we'll be talking all about Ahmed Chalabi in the next half hour here.
Yeah, well, he was also a student.
Interesting. All right, hey, I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Justin Raimondo from Antiwar.com, all about the neocons. Stay tuned. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Justin Raimondo from Antiwar.com. And before we jump straight into the Iraq War and the current batch of ex-communists and Straussians in the Bush administration, Justin, I want to give you a chance to address the legacy of William F. Buckley and National Review and the part that that magazine has played in transforming conservatism from being a philosophy of limited government and individual rights into being a philosophy of warfare and welfare statism.
Okay, but, you know, like prior to doing that, let me just tie up this whole Shackman thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I mean, so you have to understand that as these people lost their faith in socialism, another god, you know, appeared, and that was the god of democracy, capital D. And Shackman began talking about how we have to spread democracy throughout the world. Okay? It was no longer socialism, really, though it was social democracy, a kind of watered-down
people. So they saved their forms, but they updated their details a bit.
Exactly. And so, I mean, that's how we got from Trotsky to Shackman to the National Endowment for Democracy. And it's basically the same idea. You can't have democracy in one country, America. It has to spread throughout the world.
That's what George Bush said in his inauguration speech, right? That liberty here depends on liberty all over the world.
Right. I mean, that speech pretty much crystallizes the whole crazy, revolutionary, and very anti-conservative idea. Yes. That speech.
Yeah, very good. Okay, now, National Review. This guy, William F. Buckley, it brings to my mind, I mean, if James Burnham and all these guys were the founding members of National Review, then it's really not even neoconservatism, is it? It's just plain old conservatism if it's been since the 50s.
Labels don't really mean that much anymore, especially today. But just to give you some idea, the founding editors, if you look at the founding editors of National Review were mostly ex-communists. When Whitaker, Chambers, all these commies, basically, who had, been disillusioned by the crimes of Stalin, and now were obsessed with their old enemies in the Kremlin. And so, the goal of National Review was to destroy communism. And they didn't care how they, in fact, Buckley himself said that we have to accept a totalitarian regime on our own shores. He said this in an article for Commonweal magazine, I think it was in 1952. High taxes, a centralized government, massive armies. And then after we smash communism, then we can have, limited government, less taxation, and roll back the state in general.
Which is exactly what happened, right?
Right. If you keep postponing these goals, then eventually you're going to forget about the goals. And, the means will become the ends. And so it has occurred.
And in fact, the perfect example and the perfect segue into really the next part of our discussion would be Paul Wolfowitz's leaked memo from 1991 after the Gulf War, when the totalitarian bureaucracy was not dismantled at the end of the Cold War, but in fact went and found new enemies to fight. Then that's where Paul Wolfowitz first wrote down his neoconservative doctrine for American world domination, right?
Right. Yes. Right. In fact, Pat Buchanan has a whole good analysis of that memo in his book, A Republic, Northern Empire. I would suggest your readers get a hold of that.
And really, throughout the Clinton years, the neoconservatives, they weren't so much really loyal to the Republicans. A lot of them sort of jumped ship and supported Clinton for a time at least, right?
Oh, yeah. They liked Clinton because Clinton was into intervening everywhere. It's interesting to see all these Democrats now who are, we're anti-war. In fact, lots of our readers at antiwar.com are, dyed-in-the-wool Democrats, very partisan, but they forget that Clinton was, a super interventionist. He intervened in Haiti, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, tragically. He bombed a pharmaceutical factory that made aspirin in the Sudan. He continually bombed Iraq. He bombed Afghanistan. The man was crazed.
Hell, he bombed Waco 100 miles up the road from here.
Right. And he bombed Waco, yes. So,
the neocons, adventures of the neocons during the 1990s, and they were putting pressure on Bill Clinton to invade Iraq that culminated in some sort of resolution that Clinton signed in 98 about regime change, right?
Right, right. It was called the Iraq Liberation Act. And basically, that's when Chalabi started getting his money. They were funding Chalabi even then. And the Democrats were all for that back then, back when Clinton was proposing the legislation. But when Bush wants to do it, suddenly it's not a good idea.
Well, and then Bush takes office, and within a month, he's already bombing the no-fly zones and punishing Iraq for so-called transgressions. And then after September 11th, we have it from Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, and from Richard Clark, the former head of counterterrorism, that on September 12th, they were already talking about invading Iraq and that the neocons had their chance. Why is it, do you think, Justin, that the neoconservative faction was so intent on invading Iraq, which clearly had not a thing to do with September 11th?
Well, if you go back and you look at, you know, the public policy statements of these people, I mean, for over a decade, they've been agitating ceaselessly to invade Iraq. And if you look at Pearl, David Wormser, and a whole bunch of other neocons wrote a policy paper called A Clean Break. And they wrote it as advisors to then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And what they were saying was that, look, Israel is in crisis. It has to break out of its corner. It's backed into a corner by the Intifada, by internal contradictions, by its failing economy, by too much aid from the U.S. And so it has to break out and start expanding. People weren't coming to live in Israel because, of course, like there were problems there, of course, with the Palestinians. So they had, they wanted to get rid of the Palestinians, and they wanted to get rid of their enemies on every side, especially Syria. And Syria was seen by Pearl and others as the main enemy of Israel, the frontline state. So how do you get to Syria? Well, they posited that the road to Damascus runs through Baghdad, and that first you had to get Baghdad.
And so I guess Benjamin Netanyahu didn't take them up on their plan, right?
Well, I mean, he couldn't implement it.
So he just sent them off to America to get it implemented here.
Well, I mean, basically that's what happened. Like whether he sent them off or not is, not really relevant. But, that's what happened. If you look at A Clean Break, you can see that the entire goal of U.S. policy in the Middle East toward Iraq has been Israeli-centric. We have no legitimate interest in Iraq. Iraq never threatened our interests at all. And, in fact, invading Iraq was a major minus for us because it filled Al-Qaeda's ranks, recruited terrorists. It set up a terrorist enclave where there hadn't been one before. So none of this was in our interest. But if you look at it from Israel's point of view, it's wonderful. This is great news. One by one, Israel's enemies are going down in the Middle East. And that's what this whole process, this whole project of let's democratize the Middle East, that's what it's all about, really. Is making the Middle East safe for Israel. So, I mean, that's why American soldiers are dying there, and that's why Iraqis are dying, to make the world safe for Israel. Now, if you think that's a valid reason, then people ought to say that. But, I mean, that's what's not being said. So it's about time somebody said it, and I've been saying it from the word go.
Well, and you've also been over and over again referring to a tiny little group of neoconservatives inside the Pentagon and how they were the ones individually and collectively who lied us into war.
Right. And, I mean, if you look at the Israeli connection, I mean, there must be some reason why the FBI raided the Washington headquarters of AIPAC not once but twice recently. I mean, what's up with that? What's been happening is that Israel has penetrated the Pentagon. It's clear that this guy Larry Franklin, who's a Pentagon analyst and is an Iran specialist, was leaking secret documents to Israel through AIPAC, and that's what this whole investigation is about. And it's now about to blow. So now we're going to see that some people were right about this.
Well, it also seems, according to a couple of sources, I know Julian Borger and The Guardian and James Bamford in the book Pretext for War, they talk about the information going both ways, that it wasn't just spies in the American Pentagon giving information to the Israelis, but that, in fact, there was a little office of special plans in Israel that was funneling some of this bad information in the run-up to war over to our side to be used against us.
Right. I mean, like, there was this whole outfit here set up by Douglas Feist, who's a pro, very pro-Israel, former director of policy at the Pentagon. And, I mean, their job was basically to cherry-pick intelligence and make the case for war, to mold the intelligence to mean what it didn't mean. And there was a parallel group set up in Israel, and that they were funneling so-called intelligence from Israel to the Pentagon here, and then via Vice President Cheney's office, it was winding up right on the president's desk. So access. It's all about access to power. I mean, that is what the neocon method is all about. Whispering in the ear of the ruler and influencing through access. And it succeeded magnificently. I mean, look where they are.
So really, it's having
inside
that,
the Middle East, they're you know, it's
that third and fourth level policy position that that's where the power really is. That's where the influence is really to be had. I mean, being the assistant to the deputy secretary of something for something.
Well, right. I mean, because you know, once you get all your people in there, and then they, you know, then they rise. It's part of a national security bureaucracy that they're embedded in. And there are nests, literally, of neocons throughout the federal government. And they're funneling information this way and that without regard to national borders. And they're getting in trouble for it. So now we'll see what happens.
Well, let's talk about some of that trouble. There's two separate investigations, right? One of them into Larry Franklin. And then there's, I believe, a separate grand jury that's hearing evidence about the leaking of the name of Valerie Plame, right? Is there some convergence between those two investigations?
Yeah, I mean, it's all very murky because, you know, of course, it's a grand jury or, you know, a series of grand juries, and so, that you know, it's all secret.
Right.
They aren't telling us. They aren't holding press conferences. And then there's even another rumored grand jury investigation into the Niger uranium mystery. I mean, how did that get into the president's speech? Well, the president's 2000 and I believe it was 2003 State of the Union message, where he said Saddam has tried to get uranium from an African country. Now, that was based on a forgery that somehow got into the U.S. intelligence stream. Who put it there? We don't know yet. And so how did that happen? And that's tied into the Plame thing, because, of course, that's what, you know, that's what that was all about.
We got another investigation, too, into Ahmed Chalabi and his connections to the Pentagon and his connections to Iran.
Right. And yes.
Now, we know that he's been giving them, he was, I guess, caught giving them codes to intercept American messages, but Ted Galen Carpenter at the Cato Institute has asked the question of whether Chalabi was really working for Iran all along, and that they were, like Israel, helping provide the pretext for war because it was in their interest for America to come and get rid of Saddam, too.
Right, yes. But, I mean, you have to realize that there is a connection between Iran or, see, you can't look at Iran as just a single monolithic thing. There are all these factions, and remember Iran-Contra and Michael Ledeen and his connection to Iran?
Ghorbanifar, right?
Right. And so there's all this, it's all, you know, I mean, it's Byzantine. You know, conspiracy theorists could have, you know, a ball with all this stuff. And yes, there's all these investigations, but the key thing to remember is that very few people are involved. It's all the same people that are being investigated for different things, for different crimes. So
there really is a very small number of actual neoconservatives in the administration, right? Libby, Wolf, Abrams, Feith, Shulsky, Pearl, Hadley, Ludi, Wormser. That's about all I can come up with.
Well, right.
And two of those are gone.
People that, you know, like, you don't know who they are. Like,
right.
Nobody knew who Larry Franklin was.
Right.
Right, and, you know, until he became famous or infamous.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but, you know, like, there's an old joke that, yes, you know, there are only, like, you know, 20 neoconservatives in the entire world, but 17 of them are newspaper columnists for major newspapers.
All right, everybody. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Justin Raimondo, author of Reclaiming the American Right and head writer for antiwar.com. We'll be right back. All right, guys. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Justin Raimondo from antiwar.com. And, Justin, I want to ask you what you think the relationship is between the Yankees, the Cowboys, and the neocons, and who's really playing who. I talked with Tom Barry a few weeks ago, and he said that he thought that the neocons basically were useful for articulating a policy that they all wanted done, but that they never really took control of the government or really gained dominance. And then I look at the fact that George Bush is from Connecticut, I guess, stayed here in Texas for a little while, but he's basically a Yankee type. So on the face of it, it looks like the Cowboys and the neocons have kind of teamed up against the Yankees, but then again, I'm not really sure. What do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that there aren't many Yankees left, so I would sort of count the Yankees out. I mean, the day of the Yankees is over.
They're just the Democrats now, huh?
Right, and they're not very Yankee-ish anymore. I mean, you know, I would say that, you know, to say that the neocons never really took control of the government, well, I think you have to look at, you know, the Woodward book, where he says, in effect, that there was a coup d'etat, and that they basically took over. You know, I mean, people think that George W. Bush is in charge. I got news for you. The real president is Dick Cheney. Cheney's in charge.
Well, Cheney's got a balance between the oil men and stuff, too. Like, there was the fight about who's going to control the oil. I see Chalabi's back in there now, but there was a big fight where apparently James Baker and the oil men kind of won out over the neocons, and they insisted that the Iraqi oil stay nationalized rather than being sold off as Chalabi and the neocons wanted.
Well, I mean, you know, so they're fighting over the spoils. I mean, that's not a, you know, that's not a real fight. Though actually Baker and those people are pretty good on, you know, the question of intervention. Actually Scowcroft, not Baker. But, you know, I think this, you know, the Cowboys have no ideology. I mean, you know, they're the body and the neocons are the brain.
Right.
And there are no more Yankees.
Well, let's move it out of the Middle East here and talk about Russia. We basically, which, you know, we only got 2 or 3 minutes left here, but really, but NATO's expanding all through Eastern Europe. We got troops all through Southern Asia now, with the exception of Iran, I guess. Looks like we have Russia surrounded. What do you think's going on there?
Well, I mean, get ready for the new Saddam, because it's either going to be Putin or it's going to be his successor. And they are looking to see. Of course, Condi is, like, you know, hectoring Putin, saying, now, you promised you're not going to seek a third term. Can you imagine if Russia had said to FDR, no third term? I mean, it's just incredible. The arrogance of our government is just knows no bounds. And Russia is next. You'll be hearing about Russia. It's a new Cold War, and you know.
Well, they better keep it cold if they're going to have a war, because Russia still has thousands of nuclear warheads, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, this is not somebody we want to slap in the face too hard.
Right, but I mean, what they're going to do is they're going to try the old Ukraine, well, the new Ukrainian template, and they're going to try and overthrow Putin or his successor with a kind of a, you know, a color-coded revolution, you know, an orange revolution inside the Soviet Union. I mean, that is definitely on the agenda.
And that's definitely playing with fire right there.
Yeah, I mean, yes. But, of course, the neocons will have their old enemy back, the Kremlin. They can scream about the Kremlin and Russia and throw in, oh, yes, you know, they're anti-Semites and, you know, they're neo-Nazis and it's the new Hitler.
Yeah, the present danger, right?
Right. And so they're all popped up. And in fact, it's interesting to note that they're even pro-Chechen. And this American Committee for Peace in Chechnya.
Oh, I'm sorry, Justin.
All these neocons. And these guys are pro-Chechen.
We got to do this again sometime soon. Justin Raimondo, he writes for antiwar.com. Stay tuned.